Welcome to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. It is Black History Month and also Friday when the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center holds its weekly fireside chat, these days via Zoom. For this week's chat, organizers decided to combine both Black History Month and parks, and tonight's presenter is Shelton Johnson. Now, that name may ring a bell to you because he was one of the rock stars in the Ken Burns National Park series, and Oprah also featured him in two of her programs. Currently, he is a park ranger at Yosemite, where he delights visitors by portraying a Buffalo Soldier, the name for Black soldiers that served in an all-Black company from the times going back to the Civil War, a name for them coined by Native Americans who thought their hair reminded them of the curly, dark hair between the horns of a buffalo. Well, Shelton Johnson's mission is to encourage African Americans and people of color to visit the nation's parks because they are sadly underrepresented. I interviewed Shelton Johnson a few days ago. His passion for wilderness, he says, began when he was an army brat and his parents took him to a mountain range in Germany. What was your first quote-unquote wilderness experience?
Well, my first wilderness experience was that mountaintop in the Bavarian Alps when I was 5 years old, when we lived in Germany. That's what I can't forget, that experience of being on a mountaintop and staring down into an abyss and seeing clouds 1,000 feet below me and then seeing the shadows of those clouds cast on the earth 1,000 feet below them. And that really gives you, if you're a kid, you know, that's something that you never forget. I mean, it's like a view that you would have if you were in an airplane. But I wasn't in an airplane. I was just standing at the edge of a railing. It's kind of like John Muir, you know, you kind of thought of being in the wild as a baptism of sorts. And it was more secular than sacred, but it was still very sacred in terms of the impact of those mountains on a small child who really felt like he was being, and I mean this in a very secular way, being born again. So it's not in the Judeo-Christian tradition of that phrase, being born again, but it's more of a second awakening, if you will.
Well, he went on to grow up in Detroit. And joining me now to talk about tonight's presentation, and I think it's going to be a real treat for those who join the Zoom presentation. We're here with Barbara Miranda and Amber DeBartoleben to talk about some of the other offerings as well from the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area. But Barbara, I want to start off with you because you know Shelton Johnson. How?
Honor, really, of working with Shelton in Yosemite National Park in the 90s. I got there in 95, 96. I was tasked with doing wilderness education and outreach across the state of California. And we really wanted to bring diverse stories to the folks that live near national forests and national parks and reveal these hidden histories. And Shelton, who became a friend of mine over the years of working together, was a park ranger there, and he discovered a photo in the Yosemite Library, that a picture of these African-American soldiers. And he was like, look at this. And he did all the research, and we worked together to put that story online and to do seminars to get the story about these African-American early park rangers, because that's really the role they served, not just in Yosemite, but also up here in Alaska. The Buffalo Soldiers, not the same ones, but certainly they intersected at the Presidio in San Francisco, also came up to Skagway and helped with the Chilkoot Trail and the access to the Yukon for the gold during the Gold Rush era. So we bonded back then, have shared quite a few Thanksgiving meals together at our house, and really have enjoyed each other's company over the years. And it was great to pull him back in to tell this story up here for African American History Month.
Well, Amber, you help coordinate these fireside chat series. What other great offerings are coming up?
Thanks so much. Well, aside from Shelton, which I'm very excited about, I don't have quite the connection Barb did. I'm just a fangirl that happens to be a park ranger that watched Shelton on his first television appearance and was really affected by it. But after Shelton this Friday, or today, we have next Friday, we have the Hidden History of Avalanches, which is a really interesting thing about avalanches and reading the history of avalanches through tree rings. Really crucial here in Juneau because we are one of the more avalanche-prone cities in the country. And this year especially, I believe we've had the most avalanche deaths in the nation in quite a while. So it's a very crucial. We also have a lecturer from University of Alaska Fairbanks, Amanda Kelly, that's going to talk about ocean acidification in Alaska. Also really crucial to our marine resources up here. And the ocean in Alaska impacts the entire world, so crucial to everybody. And then we also have a study on deer density here in Southeast Alaska, and we're going to wrap it up with a little bit of forest therapy on March 19th at 7 p.m., talking about health and wellness from time spent in nature.
Forest therapy. I think that Shelton Johnson was alluding to that in his childhood experience with the wilderness. And I guess that's probably what draws most people to the parks is forest therapy, don't you think?
Absolutely.
And of course, we have a lot of therapy opportunities in Alaska. Well, I want to play some more of my conversation with Shelton Johnson about why African Americans are underrepresented when it comes to visiting America's parks and also among the ranks of wilderness rangers. So you mentioned, you know, how unusual it was for an African American to have the kind of job you have. Why is it that African-Americans, you think, don't typically use our parks?
Well, the thing is that the answer to this is fairly complex because it has everything to do with African-American history, which is rooted in the situation where we don't necessarily feel as comfortable or nearly as comfortable as Euro-Americans going into these environments because there's an associated negative history rooted in Reconstruction that we haven't forgotten. So slavery is literally part of that story, but it's not really so much slavery as it is Reconstruction. I mean, there was a period of time post-Civil War, which was one of the most virulent periods or virulently racist periods in American history. I mean, the historian Rayford Logan said that the nadir, the lowest point in African-American history, was around 1901. And it was lower than during slavery, because during slavery, there's no hope, essentially, for something better in this world. If you were born around 1700 or so, 1750 in there, your great-great-great-grandparents had been enslaved and your great-great-great-grandchildren would be enslaved. And you didn't know that was going to occur, but that's where you were. And so it was just a completely different experience for someone or people who were indigenous to the coast of Africa, who had an innate connection to the natural world. As like the students that I taught when I was in the Peace Corps in West Africa, I remember one of them, he told me the names of the birds that we could see around us in his native language, what animals were around us in his native language. And he had this obvious kinship, this obvious connection, familiarity with the natural world around him. I had the opposite upbringing in urban America, in Detroit, where there were deciduous trees outside of my house. I didn't know if they were an oak or if they were a maple. I didn't know what they were. I just knew that they were trees. And I think a lot of kids, a lot of youth, don't have that familiarity with silviculture, with forestry, with what trees are around them, what plants are around them, unless they have someone in their family that makes a point of teaching them and introducing them to that aspect of the natural world. So what I'm saying is that there's been a steady estrangement from the natural world for African Americans that began with the Middle Passage, continued with slavery, and then definitely was reinforced during that period of Reconstruction. And it's the only thing that I can come to in my own mind that explains this incredible separation, this severance of the psyche and the spirit from the natural world that is historically rooted. Because I'm there in Africa in the Peace Corps, and all these young people around there have this connection to the earth that's very comparable to the connection that a lot of indigenous youth in the Americas still have to their ancestral homelands. But, you know, when you think about the Middle Passage, that was the first break right there, because frequently enslaved Africans were shackled next to Africans of a different nation, a different tribe, a different culture, who spoke a different language. So that loss of language led to a loss of the language of your people, the loss of the memory of your people, the loss of the connections you have to your ancestors. And then when you arrive in the New World, you're treated like cattle, and you're sold off, and the other people that are of African descent around you, they frequently may not know who they were, meaning what nation they belong to. And so when I'm in Liberia, I'm meeting folks that are Kru, they're Pele, they're Bassa, they're Mandinka, they're all these different indigenous ethnic groups. And most African Americans no longer have those connections unless somehow through the family, through parents and grandparents and great grandparents, word of that was passed down as what happened to Alex Haley. Alex Haley is one of those exceptional families. He had the memory of Kunta Kinte that was passed down from parent to child to parent to child. And so he used that as a means of rediscovering and rerouting himself back to the indigenous homeland of his family. But most African Americans don't have that or have not had that type of passage of memory of the ancestors into the present.
So basically you're saying that slavery separated African Americans from the land.
It's a bit reductionist. It's not just slavery. It's the process of the Middle Passage, slavery, that period, and Reconstruction. Because the thing to keep in mind, when enslaved people escaped from plantations, the wilderness around them was not a negative. It was something that they were familiar with. The plants were different. The soils were different. The geology was different. The position of the sun was different. But it was nature. It was natural. It was green. So that felt like home in its own way. But during Reconstruction, you have the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. You have an incredibly oppressive system that came into play that actually, to a great degree, inspired the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler and his treatment of the Jewish people. So you have all this virulent racism around you. But during Reconstruction, nature was not something that was positive because there were slave catchers out there. There were people literally trying to hunt you down and return you to your former position. So you couldn't take a regular road or street or what have you out of the South. You needed the Underground Railroad to access freedom, not just physical freedom, but psychological, emotional, and spiritual freedom. So you're traveling in the dark. You're traveling at night. You're traveling on trails and paths that are not normally taken in order to not be caught. And so that's one of the reasons why I often argue that Harriet Tubman should be mentioned in the same breath as John Muir or vice versa. Because John Muir talked about the freedom of a mountaineer, the freedom of being in wilderness. But Harriet Tubman was talking about the passage through freedom or the passage through the wild to secure freedom. You know, for me, that is an incredible wilderness journey just to be a part of the Underground Railroad. Because you can't just follow the regular paths, the regular streets, the regular roadways. You have to be unseen to avoid capture. So all of this is so interwoven with the continuum of the African-American experience, beginning with the Middle Passage, not just something that can be parenthetically placed to just slavery. It's like we get so caught up in dualism. We get so caught up in this whole Cartesian thing of it's tall or short, it's big or small, but really there's just this flow of transformation that's taking place in the psyche of African-Americans over a period of 400 years. Now, post-Civil Rights Movement, those barriers in general are not there anymore. But the problem is that the internal barriers, that acceptance that of the idea that we are not necessarily welcome in such environments, that's harder to get rid of. And so really what's keeping a lot of African-Americans from visiting the national parks are not external barriers. It's barriers that have been internalized for over 100 years, barriers that existed, you know, in the 1920s and 30s that led Victor Hugo Green to create the Green Book, so that African Americans knew that there were safe places that they could travel where they would be free or freer of insult, both physical and psychological.
Unless you hear these stories, you're not going to understand it.
That's right. That's right. If one grows up privileged, male, Euro-American, these stories don't really exist. You don't have to think about this because, you know, that phrase, the world is your oyster. I mean, if you have money, if you're a gentleman, so, and I'm intentionally talking about gender now, because look at the right to vote for women, you know, 1920. Why did it take so long? And then African Americans couldn't even vote in 1920. And other people, other women as well of color. So the point that I'm making is that it's easier to see these stories if you've experienced something like that. It's harder to see these stories if you haven't had that experience, because then you're just intellectualizing, what would it be like if I couldn't go somewhere because of my ethnicity or my religious background or the color of my skin? What would it be like?
Let me ask you this, though, is if you are privileged and never experienced racism in this way, isn't the best way to find out, the next best way is through a story, like the stories you tell?
Yeah. Yeah, that is the next best way. I mean, it's like, okay, I don't know. I'm just speaking objectively now. I don't know anything about what the African-American experience is like. Well, read Native Son by Richard Wright. Read The Color Purple. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Read Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. I mean, these great books provide a window. And you can't necessarily walk or climb or crawl through that window, but at least you can peer into a sensibility and a mindset and a story and an experience that otherwise would be hidden from you.
I would have to say every time I visit a national park in Alaska, the people that I see there are overwhelmingly white of European ancestry.
And that's what you're going to find in the lower 48 as well. If you're in Zion, Canyonlands, Badlands, that's not much different. You're not going to see very many African Americans.
What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that, from my point of view, it's the final act of the Civil Rights Movement. The final act of the Civil Rights Movement, in my mind, is this re-embrace of the earth. I mean, if you are of African descent, as my students were when I was in Liberia, they had that connection to the earth. I work today in the Yosemite Valley Visitor Center with a man named Olutumi, who is Maasai, whose village is below the rim of the Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania. And I work with another gentleman there, and he is also African, but he's from Ethiopia. All three of us are there. There's Olutumi, there's Addis right there. I'm thinking, well, here's a black guy from Detroit, an African-American who's also Indian. Here's a gentleman here from who is Maasai, and here's a gentleman here who's Ethiopian. Now, I wonder how visitors from our own country react when they walk into the Yosemite Valley Visitor Center and they see that level of complexity. Even better, if there was an Ethiopian woman that was there, of a Maasai woman that was there, or just an African-American woman from Chicago, or from my dad's town, Spartanburg, South Carolina. All of those encounters make an impact, and they have an impact, not just in African-Americans, but in everyone, because it reinforces that message of inclusivity, that message of democracy, which is innate to the National Park idea. It's right there on the Roosevelt Arch leading into Yellowstone National Park, the north entrance, for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. When those words were written, when the Declaration of Independence was written, the people did not refer to women. It did not refer to African Americans and people of color. It referred to land-owning, property-owning Euro-American men. That's what it referred to, we the people. That's who was in the room when it was written. They were Euro-American men. And if they had spelled out exactly what they meant, that would have been an even greater problem, an even greater mountain to pass, to summit, to cross. But it wasn't spelled out. And so now we can reinterpret it in a different way. And we can interpret it in a way that is inclusive of all Americans, which is really what it should be about and should have been about from the very beginning, because that's what it means to have a democracy. It comes from the Greek words, demos and kratos, government of the people. And that's why it always resonates to me when I read those words of Lincoln, government of the people, by the people, for the people.
And that was Shelton Johnson, who is tonight's presenter in the Mendenhall Glacier Fireside Chat, which are held online now because of COVID. And joining me are Barbara Miranda and Amber DeBartoleben from the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center and Recreation Area. So, Barbara, in Alaska, the focus is getting Native Americans, Alaska Natives involved in the Park Service. And of course, at the Mendenhall Glacier, that is a Forest Service recreation area. But can you talk about some of what the Mendenhall Glacier area has been doing to incorporate Alaska Natives more?
Sure. Right now we're in a big master planning process. And as part of that, we're taking a real hard look at our interpretive programming. We're developing a new interpretive plan. And of course, ice has ebbed and flowed across Southeast Alaska since time immemorial. And Alaska Native people have lived in this area since time immemorial. I am proud to say that I live and work in Occoquan territory. And I want people to, in the future, to be able to come to the Mendenhall and know that they're immersed in the Occoquan homeland and the Occoquan territory. The ice might have been here in recent memory, but people have lived in the shadow of ice here in the Juneau area for a very, very long time and have adapted to that. One of the joys I get out of driving across the line coming into the Mendenhall as the streetlights subside and you drive through the valley where the biggest population of people in Juneau live, And then seeing the joy on the local people's faces, as and there is quite a bit of diversity here at the Mendenhall. We see that when the local folks are here, you know, Juneau's a pretty diverse town, and I really love that we are sort of an urban national forest recreation area. And so with this new interpretive planning effort, we've been really reaching out to the Aucoin spokespeople and having meetings with Central Council Tlingit Haida cultural representatives and culture bearers, and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. We've had meetings with all of them to start making sure that we are going to be telling the appropriate stories at the appropriate place and really asking for input on how best to do that. So that's been a really rewarding and exciting part of my position here. And it's just baby steps, but we're looking forward to having an interpretive master plan in place and then being to start implementing specific projects. I envision a trail going out in a dredge that talks about traditional plant use and subsistence lifestyles that touches on modern and historic ways of living and harvesting from the land. And that's just one idea. There's some really generous offerings of cultural artifacts that we might be able to display in some of the new facilities here. And so all these things are really exciting and are going to take time, but we are really looking forward to letting our local and international visitors know that they are immersed in Aucoin territory when they're here at the Mendenhall.
So we're going to go back to our conversation with Shelton Johnson. And in this interview, he talks about his passion for the Buffalo Soldiers.
Well, the defining moment was when I saw with my own eyes a photograph of the 24th Infantry taken in June of 1899. And the 24th Infantry, they were on patrol in Yosemite. Because when I saw that photograph and I saw those men staring right at me, I essentially saw my father. I saw my father's, his partners or his compatriots, if you will, who served with him in Korea and in Vietnam. And so I felt this kinship to them because they had been forgotten. And I did wanted to do something about it. That's really what it boiled down to. It mattered to me that they were forgotten. I felt it was just morally wrong and reprehensible that their contribution to this country had been forgotten. And at the same time that I recognized that, I realized how difficult a story it would be to tell because I am African, I am Cherokee Indian, I'm Seminole Indian, and I'm Irish. I have all those bloodlines in me, and I recognize innately the complexity of telling the story of Buffalo Soldiers because much of that history is rooted in the Indian Wars. So I just figured that, okay, it's a difficult story to tell, then just tell the truth to the best of your ability, and that's what I've been trying to do for over 20 years is to tell a very complex, painful story and tell it as cleanly, as clearly, and as honestly as possible, and with as much inclusion as possible.
There's some saying I heard, something about a story being the closest distance between two people, that nothing closes a gap like a story. So who were the Buffalo Soldiers? In the photograph.
Well, those Buffalo Soldiers were in the 24th Infantry, but really, you know, when you look at the Great Migration, most African Americans at that time period were living in the Deep South. If an African American soldier is serving in the Sierra Nevada in 1899, 1903, or 1904, there's a pretty high likelihood that they're going to be from the South just because of where African Americans lived at that time period as a result of and the legacy of slavery. So when I finally received from the National Archives the muster rolls, which is a listing of the names of all the soldiers, African-American soldiers that served in the Sierra, I just started looking to see where they enlisted. And they were all from the Deep South. I didn't see anyone that was from the North. They were all from like Alabama or Mississippi or South Carolina, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas. And that's when I just saw the bigger picture of the story, the sense of what am I going to do with my life and how will I be gainfully employed and engaged in work that somehow is meaningful. And there are a lot of African Americans that gravitated to the military because most of the jobs that were available to them because of the racial attitudes that existed at that time were labor intensive. They didn't necessarily give one a sense of dignity, of respect, but serving your country and potentially sacrificing your life for your country, well, that was work that mattered because you're fighting for something, literally. That's why I always argue that to a great degree, the civil rights movement began in the military. The first person to fall during the Revolutionary War was a Black Indian by the name of Crispus Attucks. And it didn't stop there. It just kept moving forward through time.
Could you describe the photograph for us and tell us about your reaction to it?
Yeah, the photograph was just a picture of five African-American men on horseback, and they were staring into the camera. I mean, they were about maybe 20 feet away, 30 feet away from the person taking the picture. But that was it, just five African-American soldiers on horseback staring right at the camera. Members of Company H, 24th Infantry. It was taken in June of 1899. And when I saw that photograph, I immediately thought, okay, that guy on the right, that's Denzel Washington. Oh, that guy over there, that's Morgan Freeman. I always saw a clip from a film because I had recognized early on that if you really want to communicate a story and reach the largest number of people, it's the movies, it's the film. That's what's going to do it. And I borrowed that thought, that perception from Robert Redford. And Robert Redford knows the impact of a film. And so that's what I was thinking, because all I'm focused on at that point is communication. Amplification. I'm focusing on getting that story out, not just to African Americans, but that was, they were my focus and still are my focus, but to everyone, because it matters not just to African Americans to hear this story. It matters to Euro Americans. It matters to Asian Americans. It matters to Hispanic Americans, Latino, Latina, everyone. It matters too, because it shows that the perceptions that we have of each other are often rooted in something that is a fallacy. That is wrong. It is patently wrong. And one of those perceptions is that African Americans have very little to do with the experience of wildness, with wilderness, with national parks. And I've met African Americans who have told that to me definitively, that Black people, we have nothing to do with national parks. So then when I say to them, then explain to me why African American soldiers were serving as some of the first park rangers anywhere in the world, in Yosemite and Sequoia in 1899, 1903, and 1904. And I say that in that manner because by 1904, there were only around 10 national parks in the entire planet, just about 10. Now there are about 4,000. So we were part of a movement that literally swept across the world. I mean, Yellowstone's considered the world's first national park. It's not the world's first national park. It's the first national park in the world to spark a global national park movement. But there are parks in places like China that are older, like Wuyishan National Park in Fujian Province. I visited Wuyishan, and it was started during the Tang Dynasty, the 8th century AD. But Wuyishan did not spark a global cultural movement of the protection of land, the protection of nature. Yellowstone did, because when Yellowstone sparked that movement, the world was ready, because the world, the world that was more Eurocentric, Western civilization, was looking, it was Romanticism, it was Keats, it was Shelley, it was Byron, it was Goethe, it was all this new association of nature as a positive value versus a negative value.
So when visitors come to Yosemite, they might encounter a buffalo soldier. Where did you get the idea to portray a buffalo soldier and greet the visitors?
Well, I got the idea because when you're talking about the history of race, it makes people uncomfortable. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. And I found that if I, as an African-American park ranger or Black Indian park ranger, you know, to be accurate, talking about the plight and the challenges facing African Americans during slavery and Reconstruction, and then the America that was around 1900, it made people uncomfortable. And that's the thing about this history. It makes a lot of people uncomfortable. It makes Native people uncomfortable. It makes African people uncomfortable. It makes people uncomfortable. But you know what? So much of history, when you look at it, is an uncomfortable subject in general to tell, to talk to people about. But there was so much else in the story that I felt was really important to communicate, and that was that connection to the earth, that connection to the land. I just felt I had to just be able to communicate all of the above and do it in a way that didn't push people away too much, or if it did push them away, I could pull them back in again. And that push-pull pulls people in, it pushes them away, pulls them in. It's like being on a boat, like the Middle Passage. You're getting pulled and pushed in all these different directions, and you're just trying to hold on and survive the journey.
Aside from the Buffalo Soldiers, you're known for a lot of other things, for being part of Ken Burns's historical documentary series on the parks and how they were created. I understand that you appeared in every episode. So you're kind of famous, and I understand that people want to pose with you in photographs, get your autograph. How does that feel?
Well, the thing is, I'm not really famous. Denzel Washington is famous. Oprah Winfrey is famous. And I convinced Oprah to come to Yosemite in 2010 and camp as a means of them amplifying the story that African Americans are present in Yosemite in terms of the historical context. I felt that the best amplifier to communicate that message of welcome would be Oprah Winfrey. But it was crazy because she wanted to surprise me, and she did. So I was in shock for a day and a half, and she was only there overnight. So by the time I got my wits about me, she had already left. So I never had the conversation with her that I really wanted to have about the importance of this history.
So did she get to experience any wilderness, or was she there just to produce a show pretty much?
No, she was there camping. I mean, she camped out in Yosemite Valley, you know. She was there camping, but she had her crew with her as well. So she experienced Yosemite. She saw Yosemite Valley, which is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And she took me up on that offer and actually acted as amplifier, as the amplification of that message of inclusivity, that national parks belong to African Americans as much as anyone else. And that's really why I wrote to her in the first place. And that goes back to the beginning of our conversation, is that African Americans still avoid the experience of being in the wild, which is tied to all those other historical references that I brought up during our initial conversation.
So how did the idea come to you to invite Oprah Winfrey to Yosemite?
When you're dealing with a hidden history, a forgotten history, then the first thought that you have is, well, how do I amplify this story? How do I make this story audible? How do I make this story visible? Stories are not innately invisible. Stories are not innately inaudible. It's just that we choose. We make a conscious or unconscious choice not to see some stories. We make a choice not to hear certain stories. And so I just figured I needed to have this story amplified in such a way that people had no choice but to listen. It's basically, think about the civil rights movement. African Americans have been having challenges with regard to race and ethnicity and our treatment of same in this country since the first slave ship landed in 1619. When I wrote to Oprah, I'm looking at this story of African American stewardship of national parks being something that African Americans needed to hear in order to connect them historically and culturally to lands that they perceived as being foreign to them, being separate from them in terms of history. So when African Americans are saying to themselves, we don't have anything to do with national parks, white folks do that, I knew that that was not historical truth. I knew that that was a lie. We have this history of rootedness in such environments. And so that's why I needed to bring that story out. That's why I reached out to Oprah, because what that story needed was amplification. More people needed to hear it. And since the Oprah Winfrey Show was the number one talk show on the planet, then my thought was, then what stage could be higher, more prominent, and clearer to see and hear than the Oprah Winfrey Show and her saying that national parks belong to everyone and they belong to African Americans? That's why I wrote to her. So for me, she was the person better suited to communicate that message of inclusivity. Even though I'm a park ranger, fine, but I'm a voice literally crying in the wilderness. I mean, I'm really in the wilderness. I'm in Yosemite. But Oprah's someone that people perceive as being very urban, very sophisticated, very intelligent. And so she's there, and they're going to listen to her more than they're going to listen to me, because they can't even hear me. They don't even know I exist. That's why I wrote to Oprah. I wrote to her to issue that welcome, that greeting of acceptance, and that you're accepted here, you're welcomed here. This is your home. These parks are your parks. This place is your home.
And that's Shelton Johnson, tonight's presenter in the Fireside Chats. And I'll tell you that this is just the tip of the iceberg. He didn't get into the full story about the Buffalo Soldiers with me, and that's what he's going to do tonight. And we are joined by Barbara Miranda and Amber DeBartolaban from the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center and Recreation Area. Amber, if people are listening to this and they want to get in on this to hear this and watch this presentation, how do they do that?
Sure. They actually can watch it on our Facebook page. So you could either type in facebook.com and then just a / in Mendenhall Glacier VC, or if you just want to use the search engines, you can just put in Mendenhall Glacier Facebook and it'll come up. And it will be probably the first thing you see on the screen. And we also, on top of Firesides, we have programs for children 7 and under called the Mendenhall Minis on there. And we also have opportunities for educators to bring virtual field trips. So all of that can be found on our Facebook at Mendenhall Glacier VC.
Well, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, Amber and Barbara are going to give us an update on all the activities that you can partake of this winter. So stay with us.